Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hewlings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Hewlings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding for working artists, to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host. Our guest today is Shannon Robinson. Shannon is the curator and chairperson of Windows to the Divine, a trademark of the Colorado Dominican Vocation Foundation, of which she is both founder and president. Windows to the Divine seeks to inspire everyone to become a collector through educational programs that teach about patronage, the art industry, and philanthropy. Shannon, can you take a minute to tell us a little bit more in your own words about yourself?
Thank you, Dan. I'm pleased to be with you today. I am a retired attorney, or some might say recovering. I practiced law and commercial litigation for over 23 years, and then I turned my attention to being an advocate for artists and a consultant for the visual arts and working really on our foundation, Windows to the Divine. And I'm a passionate collector, and I really just feel very privileged to work with artists all the time. That's really what I do.
Well, now, Shannon, you aren't an artist yourself, and you have this background in trial law, but you do have a collection of over 200 pieces, and primarily these are works of living artists, some of which are emerging artists. So how did you get involved in collecting fine art?
Well, I think like most people, I kind of stumbled upon it. I was actually in the beginning stages of practicing law, and there was a woman who was a consultant who would go around to law firms and corporations and bring works of art there and try to convince people that they should be collecting. I met with her, and unfortunately, I made the mistake most people do starting, which is to say I'm ashamed to say, purchased a Monet poster. She framed it nicely, brought it back to me, and said, you know, for the $500 you spent on this, you could have had a piece of original art. And I was absolutely flabbergasted. I thought, like most people think, that original art was never something that I would be able to afford. So she kept showing me more and more works. I kept acquiring more works, and she went from my office to my home bringing me works. Eventually, my husband joked that he had to tell her that he was going to write her a check to never come again. But it was a wonderful beginning, and like most people, I think I started really fell into it and then had someone help me learn more about it and give me the confidence to really go further.
Well, you know, I think everyone has owned that Monet poster at least once in their lifetime, you know, whether it was in a dorm or the first living room they had as a kid. You know, I know exactly what you mean, and my trajectory was very similar. Somebody said almost exactly the same thing, and I thought, really? I can buy original art? But now, you're also, how did you get involved with the Colorado Dominican Vocation Foundation? Tell us more about that.
So in the mid-90s, my husband and I actually met the Dominicans for the first time. And Dominicans, by the way, they're often called the Joyful Friars. And we were immediately drawn to, they had just a wonderful spirit of inclusivity, and they also serve the homeless and the elderly in Denver, which we love. And we were really struck also by their depth of knowledge in so many fields, including art. In fact, one of the Dominicans that we got to be good friends with had a degree in art history. And as our friendship grew, a group of us decided to start a foundation that would support their work via the arts. And we were particularly struck by the connection between the Dominicans and the arts also historically. And that is to say, Fra Angelico, who of course was the great Renaissance painter, he was also a Dominican and a syndic and a friar. And we thought, what a great connect. We also found that a lot of the men that were coming in their first year of studies here in Denver were artists. They were poets, they were writers, they were very involved in the arts. So it all just kind of came together, and we thought, why don't we put together community art events under the heading of Fra Angelico's Celebration of Art and Spirituality. And from that celebration, we created the biennial national exhibition, which we called Windows to the Divine.
Wow, so that was really the inception of Windows to the Divine. So how has it evolved? What is Windows to the Divine today?
Windows to the Divine today really is a couple of things. It's mostly about, in essence, our mission is twofold. We're trying to promote patronage and philanthropy, and that's what kind of distinguishes us, I think, from any other arts organization. On the patronage side, our mission is to encourage everyone, regardless of financial means, to acquire original art and become a collector. We're big believers in that because we believe particularly in the calling of the living artist. We understand that their calling is a difficult one, And most people don't even know artists or have art in their lives, and so it's hard for them to appreciate that a piece of art is not just a commodity. It's actually someone's life, and people who are artists have a particular talent. So a big part of our mission is patronage and really trying to convince everyone in the public that we should all be patrons. And I define patronage as someone who supports the arts to the extent of their capacity. And that means everyone. Everyone can and should be a patron. And I think we should stop shying away from words like patronage and collector, which so many people do. They think, oh, I'm not a collector because I don't have money, or I'm not a patron. But in fact, I think patronage is all about supporting the artist as best you can, and everybody should do that. The second part of our mission is, which is unusual, is that through the arts and through the beauty of art, we also promote the vocation of the Dominicans. And again, as I mentioned before, we support the first year of discernment in the novitiate here in Denver. And during that program, the novices, that's what they're called, the first-year students, they spend their time in study, of course, but also out in the community, and they work in the homeless shelters, they work with the elderly, they work with the dying. And they're just a marvelous group, very diverse. So the funds that we raise go for their educational expenses and also for all of our programming for and by our artists and our collectors.
Now, we talked about the educational programs that you provide. What are some of the actual specific topics?
We have a number of topics. First of all, I'm a big believer in art history. So we do have talks about art history where we try to do literally art history in an hour, which can offend, of course, the academics, but we're all about trying to get everybody involved in the arts. So we do art history. We spend a lot of time talking about the global art market, which is very complex, but also really important for both artists and collectors to understand. We just launched, in fact, this last week at a gallery in Denver, a collaboration with Lux Magazine, where we are creating an art and design series, and I spoke to a group of architects, builders, and interior designers about the importance of incorporating original art into their design strategies. And we're really excited about the collaboration. We hope to go to galleries and, again, associations, et cetera, and really make, I hope, an impact on the design industry in a way that will help our living artists. So a real wide variety. We talk about artist investment. We talk about the art market players, art auction houses, curators, critics, museums. Really, we try to do the entire gamut of subjects that I think a collector would want to know. We talk about how to collect art, strategies of collecting art, methodologies, how to find out what you like, all those sorts of things. Anything that a collector would want to know, we try to talk about.
Well, now, you know, I think we keep using this word collector, and of course, it's the right word, it's the accurate word. And you've said, you know, we need to break down this notion that a collector is someone with enormous amounts of money who buys primarily for perhaps investment value. And so this is something the rest of us don't aspire to. And you talked about the Monet print. But beyond that, I want to ask you, you know, what do you say to people who buy prints from stores like IKEA? I mean, after all, if I like Monet, I can't exactly afford to go out and buy a Monet. And even if I could, I may not be able to find one. So, you know, what about these big box stores? What about some of the prints of famous painters? What do you have to say to people that go after that stuff?
My philosophy is that it is really important to focus on original art, and that due to globalization and the internet, there is original art in every possible price range and media out there. I really believe that is not necessary to do reproductions, and I think it's better for the artist and their vocation if everyone really tries to focus on original art. That's not to say that it has to be, you know, the master art or anything like that. You can start at art fairs, you can go to art students' leagues, you can go to co-ops. You can go on the internet. There's so many sources of art available out there in every possible budget. But I just really firmly believe that it is just not necessary to do what I would call decorative art, i.e. reproductions at, you know, various furniture stores and those sorts of things. If people would appreciate that these are human beings that have a special talent that we need to nurture, and that it not only contributes to them as individuals but to our culture, and that they buying original art are going to actually support our visual arts culture, so it's something bigger than them, I think they would say, well, it's maybe worth spending a little more to actually achieve some really big goals, some big objectives. And that's what I'm hoping we can convince people of.
Yeah, you know, I'm always a little bit disappointed when I see a work of art that's sort of borderline. It is a work of art. It's not meant to be merely decorative. It's not ultimately blandly abstract. And yet, it's occupying sort of an entryway over some shoes as though it were, you know, just a different wallpaper or something. And I'm always like, that piece of art shouldn't be there. That's a piece of art. That should be somewhere in a place of honor. It always throws me a little bit, the sort of decorative art approach. But I'm not knocking it. I realize decorative arts are an art in and of themselves. But I have another question for you, which is, you know, how does this impact the working artist? I get that your thought process here is a benefit to working artists if we convince the world that, you know, instead of buying prints of Monet, support a local artist, support an artist you like, support a living artist, support a working artist, buy original art. That has immediate value. But what about the aftermarket for those artists' work in the form of prints and G. Clays? I mean, a lot of them make their living, their ongoing living, while they're creating new work off of those prints and G. Clays. Are you sort of saying that's not the right direction either?
No, I wouldn't say that. I think every artist has to confront that issue on their own terms and decide what's best for their career. And certainly there are works in all of history that were so iconic that everybody would like to have even just a reproduction. And there's nothing to say that there's something wrong with that. There isn't anything wrong with that. Really what I'm suggesting is that, especially, for instance, in this series that we're doing with interior designers, is that what you should be doing is making original art the central focus point of your design strategy, of your home, even as a collector. That's where you should be, and that's where you should focus. And in doing that, you're doing more than simply decorating your home. You're obviously promoting the vocation of the artist, but you're also finding an outlet for personal expression, because collecting in and of itself is a creative endeavor. You're also coming into a lifestyle change, which is so wonderful, because you're going to commence on this lifelong journey of learning, which collecting requires you to do. You have to look and learn. There's just so many rewards. There's aesthetic pleasure. There's intellectual stimulation. Collecting original art, just there's nothing like it. There just isn't. And I have such a passion for it, and everyone I know who collects original art, and again, it doesn't matter what you spend or how many pieces you have. If you have one piece of original art, I think you're a collector. The point is, it is so rewarding, and it's just is so enriching for your life to be surrounded by works that make you feel good, works that intrigue you. And that's just not something, you can't get all the benefits of collecting out of a G. Clay. And I just think that it's important for people to understand the difference. And if they make the decision that, well, I absolutely have to have a huge piece over the couch, and therefore all I can afford is a G. Clay, well, so be it. But I hope that'll be the beginning of their journey, not the end. That they'll say very consciously, I'm doing this because I feel this is my objective at the moment, but I understand that I want to move along and evolve and develop my eye and support the artist and do something more than reproductions, at least at some point. And for the artists, I think, I talk to artists all the time about this. Some of them say, you know, I have a singular work that was just the best I ever did, and I want to share it with people, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. That's perfectly acceptable. And for some artists, it is a stream of revenue. And one thing I always try to tell collectors is, don't be judgmental about artists. They have to live. They have to make a living. They have children to raise and expenses like everybody else does. So give them a break. They're doing the best they can, and sometimes they have to make decisions that are business decisions that are very legitimate. So some artists may conclude that that's what they have to do. But as a general rule, I kind of say, you know, be careful when you do that, because you may be really diminishing your own future and your own talent and worth if you do too much in the way of reproductions.
And of course, so many artists don't create reproductions of every work they've ever done. They're very selective, you know, for precisely that reason. And I think the undertone of what you're saying is sort of that artists, working artists, need to support the arts as well, primarily by focusing more on generating original art than on the aftermarket, or rather the market for reproductions. So that's fascinating. And I wonder if you can just be a little more specific about what's in it for the emerging collector, the person that is hearing us now, that says, all right, I've got the $500. I'm willing to invest in original art. But it sounds like you're saying, do this. There are so many benefits, but what benefits? Exactly what do I get out of buying the original art that I don't get out of buying the reproduction?
Well, first, as I keep saying, there's patronage. And I think when you buy original art, you really are supporting the vocation of the artist. And you're creating, particularly for living artists, a current marketplace for their works. And that, to me, is just so important versus reproductions. You know, the more reproductions people crank out at a dirt cheap price, it ultimately hurts the artist who's doing original work. So to me, I think we have to be very careful about that. And if we're collectors, we want to ultimately put the artist, I say, first, and we want to help them, not hurt them. So I want people to have a demand for strong quality original works. It's kind of like, if you think about it historically, I believe that we could have a renaissance where everybody was collecting art, kind of like the Dutch Golden Age. At that time, the middle class was really strong. Everyone, bakers, butchers, everybody wanted art. They had it in their shops. The middle class supported the arts. And as a result of that demand being so strong, supply was strong. And that period of time was one of the strongest periods ever in the history of art for still lives, portraitures, all kinds of things. And I think the same thing could happen here if people would first appreciate the importance of original art and demand strong quality art. The artists will come if they're being supported. So patronage is first and foremost. Secondly, as I said before, I think that original art gives you the ability for personal expression. Now, I suppose you could have a lot of posters and say, well, this expresses me just as well, but I don't think so. And I also mentioned before the notion of course, lifestyle, because when you get into collecting original art, you're going to be studying, you're going to be going to openings, you're going to be looking at all kinds of sources, you're going to be, when you go to museums, you're going to have a passion that's much greater than you used to be. It's a totally life-changing process. And then there's also the question of artist investment. That's another thing, that reproductions are never, ever going to be worth anything more. I mean, if you're lucky, you could get what you paid for it, but unlikely. If you're talking about just straight old going to the furniture store and getting reproductions or decorative art, generally everybody agrees that there is little or no monetary value in the resale market at all. So if that is in any way an incentive for you or reason to collect, then you really shouldn't be doing reproductions.
Yeah, so part of what you're saying is that there's a relationship with the living artist of supporting them, supporting the arts, even if you don't have a direct personal relationship. That's always been a benefit for me, is that the living artists that I collect, I can actually send them a note and they'll reply, and I can ask questions or what have you. But you're also, I hadn't thought of that actually. You're talking about a time when you could walk into a shop or a home and what was there was unique. It was art that not only was there original art, but by the very fact of it being original, it didn't exist anywhere else in the world. What you saw on the wall was unique. And that's fascinating, the option, the possibility of going over, you know, a lot of us used to go over to people's houses and immediately gravitate toward the bookshelf back when there were lots and lots of books in people's homes. You know, there were no Kindles. You know, what books do they have? And of course they weren't original, but I'm reminded of John Waters' quote. You know, he's the actor and director. He said something to the effect of, we need to make books cool again. And if you go to somebody's house and they don't have books, don't date them. And I imagine that one outcome of what you're saying is, if you go over to somebody's house and it's full of prints and they don't have any original art, don't date them. That's a cultural turning point. When somebody begins to buy art, it makes them a different kind of person. So I love that. Why do you think, though, that people are reticent to use words like collector? Is it just that the feeling that they don't have the money or the word patron, or is it that it feels stodgy and there's a cultural barrier there?
I think there is a cultural barrier in the sense that it feels, when you use that term, it feels like you're being an elitist. And let's face it, the art world, the biggest hurdle, I believe, to collecting by everyone in the art world, and I mean it in an egalitarian way, is the perception that the art world is only for the wealthy and for the elite. And I think that is what keeps people from becoming collectors. They think that only the entitled get to collect art. And the problem is the market, the way it is, it reaffirms that misperception when every time you pick up a newspaper, you see a record auction price for the Picasso for $179 million last year. And people say, it just keeps reaffirming the misperception that in order to be a collector, you have to be wealthy. So I think that's the very first message we have to get out there, is that patronage is for everyone. It's something that everyone, I believe it's a moral imperative. I really do. I think everybody has to do it in order to make sure that the visual arts thrive and survive. But I think everybody's also able to do it for the most part because, again, the democratization of the original art market, if you will, because of the internet. You can get art for $50 on up to, you know, the sky's the limit. And you can find art in so many different places, and you can connect to artists all around the world through the internet, which we could never do before. So the market used to be a small place where only the blue bloods would go and only the elitists could go to galleries and fancy shows. Now everybody can get on with a click of their mouse. They can be looking at work from every artist from around the planet and at every price range. So there is no reason not to be a collector. I would argue this is the best time in human history to be a collector, because anyone can do it. Every medium is available. Every price point is available. And if we could get that message out there, that first, everyone should become a collector, and second, everyone can become a collector, I think we could just really do something wonderful and revolutionize how we view art.
I want to take a minute and say to our audience, the Clark Ewlings Fund delivers podcast courses like this at the pleasure of our audience. And that means if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month would be a welcome and appropriate way to sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Know also that a portion of our funding goes to deliver direct education to artists who've demonstrated a clear, achievable plan for transforming their businesses into self-sustaining and thriving ones that fill the world with art. Share this commitment with us now at clarkewlingsfund.org/thrive. That's clarkewlingsfund.org/thrive. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Shannon, you know, Windows to the Divine links spirituality with art and art as a unique calling. Tell us more about what you mean by that.
Well, at the foundation, we have a real belief, as I think I mentioned before, in the calling of the artist, that the profession of the artist is not like any other. I guess that kind of harkens back to the Renaissance when Michelangelo really kind of got out this notion that artists were not just craftsmen, that they were geniuses, if you will. And we really believe that artists are geniuses, and they're necessary geniuses in our society, and they have a very difficult calling. And so we feel like we want to do what we can to help them. So we not only do we try to create a marketplace for them through our exhibitions and our symposia, but we try to educate collectors. We have salons to talk about that. And we just work really hard to get across this notion that the artist is special. And in that special feeling, if you will, we obviously, in the name of our show, Windows to the Divine, we believe that there is a wonderful spirit of creativity that occupies the souls and minds and hearts of these artists. And we, again, want to do whatever we can to create an environment so that they can create works that are driven by spirit, that are not just, you know, again, we don't view art as just a commodity. We view art as something that's very personal, and it contains the spirit of the artist, which is why it's so deserving of respect and why we're so enthusiastic about supporting it. So in our exhibitions, which are very different than really any other exhibition I know of, starting with the title, Windows to the Divine, that's obviously unusual. But secondly, we tell the artists that they have the opportunity, if they wish, to provide a statement next to their work explaining how their work connects to that title, Windows to the Divine. Some artists choose to do it, some artists don't, which is fine. It invites a dialogue about what the artist is thinking, their intent, their feelings. And ultimately what we find, even though our shows are really a broad spectrum of art, we find that there is a spirit that kind of pervades our shows and what we do. And I think that spirit is, again, because we believe in the artist so much, and we really put the artist first above all commercial thoughts, etc. And I think all of that just kind of creates a warm environment, an atmosphere of hospitality, and just a special kind of environment for collectors and artists alike. And I think and hope that that distinguishes us from just your average show that's out there.
Now, what's your long-term game plan for getting designers on board, commercial designers in particular? And I also want to ask you about museums. I mean, technically, we could all visit our favorite pieces at local museums. So are you attempting to get them on board in some way? Is that an alternative to collecting art, or do they have a role to play in your mission as well?
Museums certainly have a role to play. I guess I start from the premise, again, that everyone should be a patron, and that starts by supporting arts education, which the obvious candidate there would be our museums. And so I always want everyone to go to museums, support museums. When I talk to people about becoming collectors, I urge them to look and learn, and one of the first places to do that would obviously be art museums, but not just to go to art museums, but to become involved in the art museum. So I always tell people, please consider joining support groups at museums. So for instance, the Denver Art Museum, we have the DAM Contemporary, as they call it. We have Friends of Painting and Sculpture. I'm a member of that support group. And they have fabulous programs that are educational, give you much greater depth, and gives you more of a commitment to the institution itself, to its collection. So I think museums are very important, and we as a nonprofit work with them. In fact, we had our Collectors for Connoisseurship, which we launched last year, which is a nationwide network of collectors and artists. We launched it at the Denver Art Museum, and we held a symposium called The Renaissance of Realism, where we had educational programs about the history of realism, and we held the symposium at the same time of the Wyeth exhibition at the Denver Art Museum. The curator, Dr. Timothy Standring, was our keynote speaker. Peter Trippi from Fine Art Connoisseur flew out from New York, and we did a joint presentation on the history of realism, and we also had panel discussions with artists and collectors and industry people. And we will likewise be doing the same sort of thing this fall. We're going to be actually focusing on a different theme, which is abstraction and representation, finding common ground, and we will have an exhibition at Space Gallery, where we'll have experts coming in talking about those subjects, and we'll also have special programming at the Clifford Still Museum to showcase their collection because it's their fifth anniversary. Next year we'll go to New York and we'll be involved with museums there. So we find that museums are really important in the whole process, and we work with them. Your first question was about the interior designers. Our hope with them is that we will actually get interior designers, we'll help them become more competitive and distinctive by getting them to feel comfortable in their portfolio of services actually consulting about art and making art the central point of the plan. We're hoping they'll sit down and say, in addition to a budget for the kitchen, let's have a budget for art, and let's not wait until the whole project is done and we're run out of money. Let's make art a center focal point, not make it last. And I think if we can get the design industry more comfortable with the art industry, if we can develop relationships between the designers and the experts in the art industry so that they can feel comfortable and confident that they're steering their clients in the right direction, I think we could have a wonderful, tremendous impact on the market, particularly, as I mentioned, the living artist market. So I'm really excited about that option and that program, and I think it has tremendous potential. And again, we just rolled it out a week ago, so we shall see where it goes from here, but I anticipate that it's going to be quite popular.
All right, so let's dig into this a little bit. You've partnered with Lux Magazine to do a presentation on the importance of incorporating fine art in the actual planning of architects and designers' works. And, you know, there may be architects and designers listening to this who wonder, you know, why can't the painting just be bought after the room is finished? Why incorporate it in the actual design elements of the space from the beginning of the design process? Can you dig into that a little more with us?
Well, the problem is the current paradigm for some, not all, designers is clearly to go ahead and focus on the furnishings, focus on the color of the walls, the color of the furnishings, and get all that acquired. And then once that's all done, then we look around at the walls and we say, okay, let's go find some art that will fit. That leads to oftentimes reproductions, and sometimes it can also, I mean, it doesn't mean you can't have original art, but the original art, oftentimes the hunt for it is dictated by size or color only, and rather than focusing on the interests and passions of the client. And what I want to really get across with interior designers is that you can be so much more competitive and distinctive in your services if you would sit down with a client and first of all advise them of the importance of original art, which we've talked about already in this program, patronage, it's an opportunity for personal expression, lifestyle, investment, all these other things, but also give them a means to determine and discern what their tastes are. I think just like interior designers and architects have a real tough job of figuring out what a client's tastes are when they're doing the design, the same kinds of strategies can be used in figuring out people's tastes in art. So I like to talk to the designers and folks about creating their own library of images of artworks from galleries with whom they have a relationship, put those images before their client, and go further than simply saying, tell me which ones you like, pile A, pile B. But I encourage them to actually have a conversation with them about why they like the work. You know, what drew them in? Are they interested in representational art versus non-representational art? If they're interested in representational art, is it the subject that drew them in? Do they like landscapes, still lives, figurative, etc.? Is it that they like the emotion that was provoked in them when they saw it? Do they like art that's romantic? Is it the story that the painting was telling them? There are all kinds of questions that you can ask someone to really kind of help them get a focus as to what they like. I think as a general rule, we just kind of say, buy what you like, and I'm a big believer in that, as is most of the industry. But sometimes that's not very helpful. You feel overwhelmed. Well, how do I find out what they like? I don't even know what I like. And I think there are techniques and surveys that you can do that really can get a much better handle on that. But you then also have to, I believe, as a service provider, have the relationships with the experts, because art is overwhelming. It's a vast subject. It's a huge industry. It's a not very well regulated or transparent industry. So it's very important to have people you trust to go to for advice and also to go to for those acquisitions. And I think all of that can be done through collaborative programming like what we have proposed and we're doing with Lux. We're kind of bringing all these people together in one place. I think the potential is huge, and I really think it's really exciting.
Well, let's turn back to the burgeoning collector for a moment. So I think a lot of people are wondering, all right, so in theory, I agree with you. I want to get involved in purchasing original works of art. I get that I can afford it. I've overcome the cultural issue, or I think I can do that with being a patron and a collector. I'm not scared away by the terms. And I hear you. Go to a museum and learn so that I have an idea. Of course, not all of the work of living, working artists is going to show up in my local museum. So how do I know what art is good? How do I learn to trust my sense of taste? How do I know what to pay? You know, and what other questions do I need to consider?
Well, that's a lot of questions there. First of all, I think, as I said before, the first step is looking. And I would encourage everyone to not just go to museums, but I would encourage them to go to art shows, subscribe to magazines, take an art history class, consider going to your local Art Students League and take an introductory class, especially if you could do some hands-on kind of class to just kind of get a sense of what materials are. Go to art fairs, art auctions, obviously galleries. They should get on the gallery's mailing list so that they're advised of shows and they can kind of start watching artists. I think that's all part of it. But it's really all about, I think, to become a collector, what you really need to do is say, listen, I am going to devote some time to this process. It's a wonderful lifetime journey, and you're going to have to look. So I need to look at a lot of places, but ultimately, I think you want to develop an eye for art, an eye to your question of how do you know if it's good or not. That's something that each of us has to come to at some point. You can, and many collectors do, they just, in essence, defer to someone else, an advisor or whomever, to tell them if it's good art. But to me, that's not a very satisfactory way to go through this process. This is something for you, the collector, to experience. So I think what you need to do is do some study, learn a little bit of art history, look. And when you're looking, and I'll just tell you, one of the people that I think kind of said it really succinctly was Roberta Smith. I'm sure you know she's an art critic from the New York Times, and she talks about how a critic looks at art, and it's really the same for us, I think, as collectors to look at it. She talks about you're looking, and when you look at a piece, what you want to do is you want to ask yourself, if I feel good or bad about that piece, don't stop with a good or bad gut reaction. Go further and say, why is it that I like it or I don't like it? If your eye is looking at a painting and you're drawn towards something, try to find out what is it about that particular part of the painting that is interesting you in a good or a bad way. And when you do that, what you're going to do is you're going to find yourself really breaking down paintings and looking at them very closely and paying attention. And that process is, in effect, training your eye. And what it also does is it builds up a mental image bank, if you will. And that is you'll have in your head all these other paintings you've seen. And ultimately what you're going to try to do as you become more and more, have more expertise, is you have this mental bank of things you've seen, good versus bad. And when I walk up to a painting, that your brain kicks in at that point and says, okay, you're measuring comparatively, usually, against something. And so you want to have as many things in that mental image bank as you can so that you can sit there and compare and make some sort of judgment. You know, ultimately, again, we say buy what you like, but buying what you like really starts with a gut instinct, but the more you learn about art, the more you appreciate, the deeper that appreciation will be, and it'll grow into a real judgment, a discernible judgment about art. And that's when you can come to the point where you're saying, art is either good or bad, but it's a long process, and I've been collecting for 30 years, and I still have so much to learn. So even I say there's all kinds of art that I even can't judge whether it's good or bad. There's a lot of media out there, lots of different styles. It's pretty difficult to say, oh, I can just pick up any piece of art and say good or bad. And ultimately, frankly, it's a subjective opinion anyway.
Well, so should someone who wants to be a collector seek out a reputable gallery or dealer to work with? And if so, how do they do that?
I think they should. I think they can do that. It depends on the market that you're in. But for the most part, most major cities have an art dealers association. And you have to be, a dealer has to be, do various things to be a member in good standing. And that can be a whole host of criteria, which can include having educational programming, having exhibitions for the public, lots of different things. So, you know, you should check out, Denver has an art dealers association, it's called DADA, and most cities do. So that's a place to start. Obviously, look at their websites before you even visit them to get a sense of, is it professional, does the quality look good? Look at the biographies of the artists who the galleries represent, and see whether those look like quality biographies. Go, of course, to their shows and go more than once and get a sense again of what is the quality, what is the commitment to the artist. Usually artists will be at the shows, so it's a wonderful place to meet artists. And again, you can get a sense of how passionate the gallery is in representing the artist. You know, I think most galleries, my experience, most gallerists are passionate about this. This is one of the hardest ways to earn a living, I think, being a gallerist. And so I find usually people are there because they have a passion for a particular type of art or whatever. They really do believe in their artists. But that's not to say that there aren't galleries who are just there for the commerce and they have no interest. And you can kind of discern that when you even go into a gallery. And I encourage people to interact with gallery staff. It'll tell you an awful lot about the gallery. Ask questions. And if they can't be bothered with you because of the way you're dressed or whatever perception you think is going on there, then move on, because there's plenty of other good galleries out there who do get it, who are knowledgeable, who will tell you why they're representing the artist they're representing. And it's a lot of information that you can glean, but you have to just kind of have the guts to ask the questions.
Well, is there a do you want to go beyond with another criteria, beyond what constitutes a reputable gallery, to sort of some ethical criteria? I ask this because your organization is, you know, founded primarily on moral and spiritual concerns. So is there an issue of how they treat their artists? Is that something that the collector should factor in when approaching a gallery?
Yes, I think so. Now, it's sometimes difficult to discern that. But for me, because I'm dealing with galleries, I probably know more behind the scenes than the average collector. But certainly, I'm always concerned about, are artists getting paid? I like to know if a gallery, for example, has an escrow account where they, when they get the funds from the buyer, they put it into the escrow account so that the artist gets paid. Again, and that's something I suppose collectors could certainly ask, but that's just kind of one side of the issue. Again, when I come into a gallery, if someone cannot tell me why the work is important, why they're representing this artist or anything about the artist, which happens all the time, I think that's a lack of respect, a lack of diligence, because they're supposed to be the artist's advocate and representative. And if they're not doing it well, then it's probably not a gallery that I would want to deal with any more than necessary, that's for sure.
Okay, so let me ask you another question about sort of the thought process of the collector. Should they be worried at the beginning about having a cohesive collection, or is that not an issue, and they may not even know why that's important or what that means?
I think when you start, it's important. I mean, there are certainly some proponents out there who would say you shouldn't buy anything until you really have developed an eye for art, until you really have some judgment. But my feeling about that is the process of collecting is such a wonderful adventure, and it'll change your life in such a great way. Why wait? You know, I think collecting is a lifelong journey, and it's going to take years for you to have any real acumen, probably. So I think the best thing is just to get in, roll up your sleeves, and have at it. Now, at some point, as you're acquiring art, I do feel every collector owes it to themselves to sit down and take stock and think about what their goals are. I always say that collectors should think about, are they primarily a recreational collector? Are they just doing it for their own enjoyment? Or, for instance, could they be a legacy collector, someone who is wanting to pass art on to family or to museums? Or are they an investment collector? The kind of collector you are will radically impact how you go about collecting art and the kind of focus you have. You mentioned the word focus. I think for most collectors, they're just enjoying what they buy and they hang it, and that's that, and that's wonderful, perfectly acceptable. Others really like to have a focus, and they will focus on particular school, period, artists, etc. And when they do that, when they focus, the advantage of that is they can become much more knowledgeable. They also tend to focus on higher quality, and they get, in the long run, sometimes some would say a more cohesive collection. On the other hand, I would also say that for those of us who are kind of joie de vivre collectors, who just really just enjoy art for art's sake, if you will, We don't really want to necessarily limit ourselves to a particular period, a particular group of artists. We just like to be more horizontal collectors rather than vertical collectors. And so I think that's perfectly acceptable, because if the art is bringing you aesthetic pleasure and if that is your goal, then buy what you want and don't worry about it. If, however, you're an investment collector, you have to be very serious about what you're going to be doing. You have to have a focus, no question. You have to study. You're going to have to devote significant time and resources in order to do it well. So I really think the goal of the collector is very important to discern at some point in time. If, again, you're just going to be recreational the whole time, then you're good to go. But if you are going to get very serious about investment or legacy, the sooner you sit down and get that focus, the better the collection will be, and the sooner you will achieve your goal as a collector.
So we haven't talked about collecting for the motivation of investment, and most of the collectors that I've talked with have said, look, you know, for the average person, that's not an option, but even if it was, you know, there are probably better ways to invest your money. But I don't know, what do you think about that? Is this a valid, useful, opportune, wise way to create wealth?
Well, it's a big question, and we usually spend a lot of time talking about this issue. I would say that I would never say that one should acquire art for investment as your primary reason. I, like most people, agree you should buy what you like. I tend to be a recreational collector. So for me, investment is low on the totem pole, and I think for the vast majority of collectors, investment is either not a concern at all or a small part of the concern. But depending on the type and level of collecting you're doing, investment certainly can become and is very important for high-end collectors. I follow very closely the TAFAF report and the various market reports that come out every year. And, for instance, there's an important one that is done by Deloitte, Luxembourg, and Art Tactic every year. And they compared in 2016 to 2014 the collectors they surveyed. And interestingly, the level of interest in return on investment went from some 46% to like 64%. And I'm just giving you a ballpark here at the moment in terms of who these people, whether investment was an issue. Interestingly, 72% of their collectors that they surveyed said that they did collect for passion. And these are, again, the high-end collectors. But 72% also said, but they did it with an investment view. So it is important to understand that the very high-end, top-end of the market, those collectors are many of them are very focused on investment for obvious reasons. They're investing a lot of money in the market. But also we have seen a phenomena just really since the 70s and 80s where a lot of the new collectors that are coming into the market come from a financial background. They're brokers, etc. So they came to collecting from a perspective that art is like any other asset class and you should care about its worth. It should perform like any other asset. And as we see more and more record auction prices, which affirms people's belief that art is an investment, you see more and more people in that upper echelon of collectors focusing on art as investment. I think that that perception is fraught with so many risks, not only the investment risk, which are just vast, but I also think that it is very dangerous to be measuring the value of art based on price. And it's a real concern that we are seeing at the top end of the market, which is to say, first of all, people are coming in collecting at the top end right away and not working their way up, which is dangerous, so they're not evolving and getting an eye. They're relying a lot on the opinions of others rather than their own evolution of thought. So what is happening, and then ultimately what they're saying, is price is the equivalent of value and whether it's good art. So we're seeing a phenomena that the higher the price, the more value people place in it. And so people are assuming if it's a high-priced piece of art, it must be good, which is really dangerous on so many fronts. And it also does set a stage for some collectors, frankly, to be duped, they could go in and somebody has a high price tag on a piece of art and they think, oh, this must be great art. It's a great investment. In fact, they just had a study of millennials recently that came out, and they were showing that many millennials are assuming that art is a good investment. I would never assume that art is a good investment. I do believe that art can appreciate if it is investment art or collectible art. I do believe in collecting emerging artists because that is where you can see a financial profit, if you will. But generally speaking, all the great works of art in history that made people money, it was because there was long holding periods. And one of the problems we're seeing now is people want to buy and flip and make all this money. And what that creates is an artificial market that really is kind of fluff and is subject to bursting. And that gives a lot of instability to the market, which isn't good for artists. So art as investment is a huge subject. There are pluses and minuses like in anything, but there are a lot of caveats to it. If you're going to be an investment collector, you really need to pay attention. A lot of people will say you'll want to go to the secondary market, focus on deceased artists because at least there's some sort of track record for them. That's more difficult when you're talking about living artists. So there's just all kinds of issues to be considered when you talk about artist investment. But again, that's happening in the upper end of the market, not really the rest of the market. And I think that's good because I think for the rest of the market, most people are just collecting because they love it. And to me, that's perfectly legitimate.
Yeah, I think one of the things that you're underscoring is the legitimacy of having an opinion. I mean, I absolutely abhor the works of Damien Hirst. I think they're gruesome and not very enticing to me. I don't want to own any of it, even if I could afford it or a print of it or anything. And yet, some people are putting a lot of money in it. These things bring, you know, the wealth of small countries goes into buying Damien Hirst's work. And that doesn't make it good art. There's honest debate. There are people that think he's a visionary and that he is a shining symbol of our times, to quote the New York Times. And there are people who think that he's merely a brand and it's all marketing and, you know, it's cheap thrills rather than enlightenment, to quote The Guardian and The Telegraph. So it depends on who you ask. And so the problem with art as investment is if you equate taste with cost, then you're no longer really entitled to your opinion. And for me, I don't know, that's what I find appalling about that direction. It'd be nice if the work on my walls became really worthwhile someday, but I'm not going to buy it in the hopes that will happen. And I'm not buying it to put in a storage facility because I just think they're probably better investments. I wonder, though, there are lots of people profiting off of art, whether for investment or another purpose, besides the artist. So, for instance, you know, it's never been easier to buy art online through online markets. Obviously, there are plenty of shows, but that means there are a lot of middlemen who are seeking to make a profit off of artists. Galleries often, they can take 40%, 50%, 60% of an artist's pay, you know, versus buying directly from the artist. So how does that impact your message or your mission to collectors? Is it just collect original works of art, or do you also have thoughts about how we should obtain that art directly from the artist through the middlemen? You know, what's your take on it?
Well, we absolutely have all kinds of thoughts about how to go about collecting. And again, one of the first issues that I think collectors need to address is, do they want to focus on living artists or deceased artists? Because that tells you which market you're going to be involved in. The one good thing, as I said before, about the internet is that it has certainly expanded the market so much that art crosses borders and cultures, and you can research art on the internet and have access to artists on the internet, which is great. Internet sales themselves of art, what I think the research indicates, at least at this point, are a couple things. First of all, the price points for internet art sales are still pretty low. I think everybody in the industry agrees. Secondly, however, internet sales are expected to continue to grow fairly explosively. Interestingly, also, a lot of people who are collectors are comfortable now with buying their art online, now usually through a gallery, but they are, if the gallery or the dealer has a good policy for returns, that sort of thing, and they have a good relationship with the gallery, people are much more confident than ever before about actually just looking at it online and saying, I will buy it. Now, as a personal side, I tell collectors that I believe that there's no substitute for seeing something in person. And as a curator who sees hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of images every year when we do our exhibitions, I am always surprised when the works arrive and I look at it and I go, oh, that doesn't look at all what I thought it was. So there's no substitute for seeing it live, looking at the texture, looking at the brushstrokes, being able to really examine the work. So I always advise people that use the internet for research, use the internet to find works, but make sure that the person who's the vendor is someone reputable, because there's just, again, so much potential for fraud. And that is the big problem with the internet. I mean, if you talk about so many of the great artists, Giacometti, they have all kinds of forgeries, or they aren't doing it, but people just create the stuff, throw it on eBay. The potential for fraud is huge. So people have to be careful about that. The lack of authenticity is a big issue with the internet. Now, I think the market is responding, and how it's responding is you have sites like Artsy, et cetera, who pair up with dealers, and so they're really just portals. But again, it's back to the dealers. And I think at some point in your budget and your process, it is important to make sure you're getting works from reputable sources, which are usually the dealers. But that's not to say people shouldn't be able to deal directly with artists. Some artists want to deal directly with collectors, some do not. Again, I think that's the artist's decision. And some collectors want to deal with artists, some don't. So that notion of a direct tie between the two is one that is changing every day, and the whole gallery paradigm is changing. We could sit and talk all day long about where is art going, how are people going to buy it. But I find it intriguing that most surveys today are indeed showing that people are getting more and more comfortable with not having an offline relationship, that online is sufficient. So that the advantage of that is it could cut out the middleman for some artists. It could mean that some artists might have great opportunities they didn't have before. Certainly beginning artists do, there's no question. I think once you become experienced, mid-career, et cetera, you just have to have some sort of representation, I think, to make sure you're getting your work in front of the right audiences. But for those beginning artists, you know, that may well be an option. Or for an artist that is a very clear niche, what they're doing, they may not need representation, particularly if it's at certain price points that are very modest. They may be able to, you know, just literally do everything without a middleman. So there's just a lot of different economic paradigms out there, and I think that's exciting, and that's good for the consumer, and hopefully, ultimately, will be good for the artist.
You know, it's fascinating what you've said. You're talking about the evolution of the sales model happening within the world of art. I don't think we've seen the last of it. You know, this happened in real estate a few years ago. It used to be that when you sold your house, you paid 7% commission, 3.5% to the buyer's realtor and 3.5% to the seller's realtor. And so it was a very expensive proposition by the time you did all the marketing and staging and everything. And now we've had, because of digital, we've had the emergence of what we call listing realtors, who for as little as $500 will put you in the MLS system and do all the stuff short of showing your house and taking the phone calls. And you do the rest of it yourself. So it's kind of a hybrid model. It's sort of, you know, for sale by owner, but it's also listed by an agent, which gives you some advantages. And of course, they're taking a much smaller percentage. I wonder if what we will see going forward will be sort of the ascendancy of the artist over the agent or over the middleman, that what we'll see is lower commissions, less control, more of the artist being front and center. And perhaps even what you're doing with Windows of the Divine will help drive that. The notion that if we all do buy original art, it could supplement what it could add to the very thing we're doing at Clark Healings Fund, which is Our goal is for working artists to become thriving artists. So that way, it seems like Windows to the Divine and us are just really natural partners.
I couldn't agree more. I've been very pleased to associate with the fund and to get to know the people who are behind it, because what you all do is you focus on particularly the business side of art, and that is such an important part of being a successful artist, and too little is talked about. And I have to say, as a lawyer, a retired recovering lawyer who is in commercial litigation, I have been astounded over the years at the lack of transparency in the art industry and the potential for fraud, the potential for abuse, artists who don't have any contracts and don't understand what their rights are. All of that really needs to be addressed, particularly in this day and age. There just isn't any excuse for being so non-transparent as the industry is. And I'm hopeful that we will become more and more transparent. And if we have more organizations like yours and ours who are designed to help the artists, hopefully that will mean better quality art and more successful artists.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, I want to ask you just a couple of more questions before we wind down the show. But first, I want to mention to our audience, if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month lets you sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Visit clarkhealingsfund.org/thrive to continue bringing content like this to the public. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Shannon, as part of your mission to educate collectors about the art market, you've actually started collector salons. And of course, our fund, the Clark Healings Fund, also sponsors collector salons. So tell us more about how it works with Windows to the Divine.
Art collector salons, again, can have a whole host of different topics. As I mentioned before, we've done things like art history. We've done building a collection. So we will talk about art as investment. We will talk about strategies, collecting principles. I spend time focusing on strategies such as should you collect emerging versus trophy artists, buying in depth versus buying in breadth, buying the best you can afford, looking at an entire body of works before you buy an artist, recognizing not all works are equal even by the same artist, talking about budget. So our salons, like I said, are kind of do the ABCs of collecting as well as art history, as well as the global art market. And the global art market, again, is a favorite subject of mine. I will be, in fact, speaking to the International Guild of Realism next week. They'll be meeting here in Denver talking about the art market and what every artist should know, and talking about the players and museums and critics and branding and the phenomenon of branding and how it has so affected the marketplace. So those are kinds of the things that we do. I'm sure we probably have some overlap in terms of collector salons between us, but again, I know your expertise is really on the business side, which I just so applaud, and the legal side in particular, because, again, there are just so many legalities out there that artists and collectors should be aware of. We can't have enough of us out there educating, as far as I'm concerned.
So, you know, I just want to ask one more thing about the salons, which is collectors tend to be lone wolves, the traditional collector, or at least kind of a very insular group. So why should collectors join with Windows to the Divine and help with your mission?
Well, I actually find that collectors have such a common passion, or some of us would say an addiction, that we love to get together and affirm each other. So yes, it is. Certainly, there are collectors that are lone wolves, as you would put it, but I find most collectors are actually pretty collegial and really want to be with each other and share that enthusiasm and excitement. So what we provide is we have the online community Collectors for Connoisseurship, where we have videos that you can watch and learn in our Know to Collect library about how to collect. But we always believe in the importance of getting people together and having in-person events. So for instance, this last year when we launched, in addition to the Denver Art Museum Symposium, et cetera, we had a special event at one of our founding connoisseurs' home, a brunch, and we saw their collection, and we got everybody together. And we always do those sorts of personal gatherings where we go to someone's home, see a private collection, we usually see a public collection, and we just have fun together. I'm hoping that we'll be traveling together when we go to New York next year. We're planning on going in October. And again, my sense with people is that collectors love to talk about their own collection and see what other people are collecting. And it's just a shared enthusiasm that great to be with people who get it, who get why you're so excited. Because let's face it, most people don't. Most people think, what? Why are they so excited about a painting? But again, we're hoping to change that so more people get excited about it, because it's just a great joy and everybody should have it. It shouldn't just be the few.
So to wind down the show, a couple of questions about your plans. What's up next for Windows to the Divine?
Next would be our November Collectors for Connoisseurship Weekend. We're having those now once a year. Last year, again, it was in relation to the Denver Art Museum and our Renaissance of Realism. This year, it'll be November 17th and 18th in Denver, and we will have an exhibition, probably about 100 works, at the Space Gallery. The theme of the exhibition, I think I mentioned before, is abstraction and representation, finding common ground. And we will have various social gatherings, tours of the Clifford Still Museum, and we will also have panel discussions. Gwen Chanzet, who is the curator of modern art at the Denver Art Museum, will be one of our panelists. So we'll have discussions between artists and collectors about abstraction and representation, and again, finding common ground. Should be a fascinating weekend, because again, we find most of us kind of get our little blinders on and we only like a particular genre or whatever. And what we try at Windows Divine is to invite everybody to the table so that we can all talk about different styles of art, appreciate good art, whatever style it is, as long as it's good, high quality, and have conversation and dialogue. And ultimately, we hope that Windows Divine will not only be about appreciation, but also about advocacy. My hope is that in Collectors for Connoisseurship, we'll put together collectors that will not only enjoy each other's company and learn together, but would also become advocates for artists they believe in. The progressive market has done a good job of that. I think the representational market has not, and I'm hopeful that we will be better advocates for artists, and that'll ultimately produce a better supply of high-quality art for everyone to enjoy.
Shannon, one last question. So you're preparing for your fall exhibition. Tell us what we can look forward to in Denver specifically this November.
Well, specifically, again, our opening gala will be Thursday, November 17th at Space Gallery. And that will be the opening, of course, of the exhibition, which, again, will be about 50 artists from around the country participating. And then on Friday, the next day, November 18th, we will have a luncheon at Space Gallery, followed by various panel discussions, presentations on abstract art and on the theme of the exhibition. Then our founding connoisseurs, who are, again, the collector members of Collectors for Connoisseurship, will have their own private tour of the Clifford Still Museum by its director, and followed by a special party by collectors who are founding connoisseurs who live right across the street from the museum, and they'll get a private collection tour. So that's what we will have on tap this year. And then next October 2017, we'll be coming to New York, and we are working with museums and galleries and private collectors. And it's going to be an incredible experience for our Collectors for Connoisseurship, so we're very excited about it.
And of course, being in New York City, I hope to be in attendance at that event, as well as other members of the Clark Hulings Fund. You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for visual artists. For more information on Windows to the Divine and Shannon's work, visit windowstothedivine.org. For more information on the Clark Hulings Fund and our Business Accelerator program, visit clarkhulingsfund.org. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Shannon. It's been really great having you.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.